Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Steve Randage to the broadcast. Steve is the Chief Information Officer of FINRA, a non-governmental organization that regulates member brokerage firms and exchange markets, such as the New York Stock Exchange. As CIO, Steve focuses on building surveillance systems that assist the company's staff in examining firms and regulating the markets. Prior to FINRA, Steve was the co-CIO of Citibank, and before that, he was the Executive Vice President, CIO, and the Head of Operations and Technology of NASDAQ. Prior to NASDAQ, Steve was the CIO of the Chicago Stock Exchange. Steve received his Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science from Northern Illinois University and an MBA from the University of Chicago. I recently sat down with Steve in his office in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as Steve discussed how FINRA attracts highly skilled IT staff by participating in industry events. Principle 2, Infrastructure, as Steve shared the three main advantages of the public cloud. Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as he discussed how the best IT teams serve as trusted advisors to the business. And Principle 5, External Partnerships, as Steve discussed how major cloud computing vendors helped train FINRA on the use of public cloud, open source, and big data platforms. We also discussed Steve's view on the future of robotics and automation, Washington, D.C.'s market for technology skills, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Transmit Security. Transmit Security designs and develops platforms that address problems in security and usability by making it easy for developers to implement advanced authentication techniques ranging from biometrics to behavioral profiling. As the risk of cyber attacks and hacks increase, companies need a more effective way of preventing unauthorized access. I recently caught up with the Transmit Security CEO, Mickey Budai. This week, Mickey shares how abstraction layers can make companies more agile by avoiding vendor lock-in and ongoing integration work.
The second one I call abstraction. There are a lot of cool technologies in the market today, and the rate of innovation is like we've never seen before. Large enterprises are adding more and more technologies and keep growing the stack of technologies they need to manage. Now, there are a couple of challenges here that need to be addressed. As the market keeps evolving in an accelerated rate, the cool technologies of today may not be that cool 5 years from now. Some of them may not be even cool by the time you end up integrating them. Now, depending on the way you integrate these technologies, it may be hard and even close to impossible to get rid of them in the future. I'm seeing customers of mine who are really eager to get rid of technologies they have adopted years ago. But even technologies they have adopted just 2 or 3 years ago, they just can't do it. It's too complicated. They are integrated deep into the stack and used by many different processes with a lot of proprietary code that manages these technologies. The result is a stack of technologies that keep on growing and eventually is very old and patchy. This is very obvious in the identity space, authentication, fraud prevention, customer onboarding, but it's also true for other categories as well. This is where abstraction platforms become really useful. When you have a lot of technologies to integrate and you're just not sure for how long you're going to use each technology, look for an abstraction platform. Instead of integrating these technologies into your systems, they're plugged into an abstraction layer and your systems use open standard APIs to that layer. You then achieve a few goals at once. First, there is no vendor locking, as you can switch between technologies that are plugged into the abstraction platform without any impact on your systems. This by itself is a huge value. Secondly, as the abstraction layer uses open APIs to connect to your systems, you can replace the abstraction layer altogether with another vendor that supports the same APIs. And thirdly, there is no ongoing integration work of each new technology to your systems. So your time to market is very fast and your cost of integration is very low.
Tune in next week for Mickey's advice on developing a network of advisors.
Bondage. Welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to speak with you today. I thought, Steve, we'd begin with your current role. You are the Chief Information Officer of FINRA. And for those who may be less familiar with the organization, can you begin with just a brief overview as to FINRA's operation, as well as the role of the CIO and IT within the organization?
Yeah, FINRA goes back to 1937. It was the National Association of Security Dealers, and then through some mergers with some other regulatory functions at stock exchanges, became FINRA 10 years ago. It's about a 3,500 staff organization with a focus on protecting investors by surveilling the markets and the broker-dealer activities.
Hmm. And can you talk a bit about your role as CIO?
Yeah, CIO. I run a 1,100 person organization, basically building surveillance systems and systems that basically help our staff examine firms and regulate the markets.
Excellent. And can you talk a bit about, obviously there is some profound and very interesting technology behind what you're describing, very significant machine learning, for example, which we've talked about in the past. Can you talk a bit about your current strategy and the use of some of these new weapons in the arsenal of IT in order to do what you've just described?
Yeah, FINRA handles a lot of data by any definition, upwards of 50 billion transactions a day, all of the quotes, orders, trades collectively across the markets in the U.S., equity markets. And as a result of that, and because we look at the historical data to look at trends over time to find market manipulation and fraud in the markets and insider trading, we have to process a lot of data. And a number of years ago, we decided that we would use open source big data technologies and databases hosted on public cloud platforms in order to handle that amount of data efficiently and with scale. That work is largely completed. And as we've completed that work, we're now moving into machine learning and advanced analytics so that we could have the machines do more of the surveillance so that we could rely less on our surveillance analysts or our people to do work that is better suited for the machines.
That's really interesting. And obviously, it has implications or parallels beyond financial services. You mentioned at the outset of that response that you handle an unusual amount of data, needless to say. For others, maybe who don't necessarily have as much data in their pool, so to say, can you talk a bit about the steps of the process that you underwent in order to first establish, make sure you're collecting the right data, synthesizing it appropriately? Some of the people implications of this, of building a team to be able to do all of this and so forth. Can you talk a bit about the sequence or how you would advise others to walk in your footsteps to do some of what you've done?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did that was rather unique is because we were early adopters of public cloud computing and open source big data software platforms, we got a lot of help from many of the founding vendors like Cloudera and Hortonworks and later Amazon Web Services to essentially train us in how to use these technologies. I think today there are likely a lot more consultants that would be available, but basically you've got to build the skills in-house so that you're not reliant on third parties over time. That's what we did the first year and a half was soaked in a lot of information on how to use the technologies and as well worked with pretty much all the major public cloud computing vendors to figure out which one we wanted to go with. Ultimately, we decided to partner with Amazon. But then building the architecture, one of the things that we've found that's quite important is that you have to build an architecture that is very much public cloud enabled in order to take full advantage of all of the opportunities across in deep down into the software stack. Because if you take a lift and shift approach, which many firms do to get to the cloud quicker, you're not going to get the advantages of being marked to market to Moore's Law, the cybersecurity advantages, and so forth. So basically, acquiring the skills, building the appropriate architecture, and then starting the actual replatforming work, which for us started in early 2014 and largely completed 2 years later. And that work was incremental so that we were moving things into production throughout that period of time. It wasn't a big bang type of implementation. And in terms of the data, one of the big advantages that we have is that we used to, because the databases that we had weren't very large because of their, you know, commercial limitations, we had to do a lot of staging of data, taking data offline, putting different data online, staging it to make it available for our analytics users to do their queries and do their surveillance. Now with large-scale big data databases in the public cloud, we can put all of our data online all the time and make it available to our users without having to have IT operations intervention on this. And then further, we're able to have them complete their queries and do machine learning prototyping on the data as well without much IT intervention at all. And that obviously, it was a big advantage because it's more of a self-serve approach for our users.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about a couple of different parts of your response as well. You talked about the need to build your own teams, that you need to build talent internally to do these, undertake these very strategic activities. But the topics we're talking about, there's a real paucity of great talent in these areas. And I wonder what methods you've used to find that talent, bring it in, ensure that people have the reason to stay, the desire and curiosity and et cetera, such that they stay with the organization. How have you overcome some of those challenges?
It's a good question. We put a lot of thought into that. We're very much participating in the industry events, whether they're hackathons at the various universities along the East Coast, hosting our own Create-a-thon. We have one coming up in September. It'll be our third one in a row. We've got hundreds of people involved in that. We're very noisy in the press and at conferences and opportunities to get awards. For example, 5 years in a row, we've been ranked as one of the top 100 best places to work in Computer World magazine. Many, many things like that. We've had dozens of speakers at reInvent, the AWS conference annually in Las Vegas. So very high profile, and that gets the message out that we're innovative, moving very fast in new technologies like cloud and open source. And that has, in and of itself, allowed us to become an attractive place to work for highly skilled IT staff.
Yep, and as we were sitting here in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., one of a couple places you have an office, I know you also have an office in New York, for example, perhaps among other places. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about the D.C. market also specifically. This is not, of course, a hotbed of financial services necessarily, which may actually be in some ways an advantage, I suppose. But can you talk a little bit about your own perceptions of the labor force here in Washington compared to Chicago or New York or other places you've worked in the past?
Yeah, I think the D.C. metro area is a highly skilled region in terms of IT. There's a lot of industries down here, including digital publishing. A lot of people think of suburban Maryland and Virginia as being, catering to the government agencies and services. I think the highest concentration of data centers and internet providers is in Virginia. And Maryland, as well, have really, really good talent, surprisingly good talent. And I would, putting the financial services aspect aside, which is not a skill that we necessarily require, because most of what we do is large scale big data processing. Yes, it is for the financial services. Yes, it is for surveilling markets. But in many regards, that's a secondary skill to the actual data management and processing skill, which is something that we obviously have to get right. And the DC market for those types of skills has been very promising.
That's interesting. You also talked about your journey to the cloud. And at this point, I think most companies would agree that that's a very important part of their strategy. There was a time, we were speaking a few years ago, where just whether an organization of your size ought to be going to the cloud or not, at least that part appears to be largely settled. There are still those who would debate as to public, private, hybrid And I know you've got a strong perspective on that. You've already begun to talk about, you know, the direction that you've gone in. Can you talk a little bit about why you are such a major proponent of public cloud as opposed to either hybrid or strictly private cloud?
Yeah, and that perspective gets, you know, stronger and more one-sided, you know, as time goes on. Because of the advantages that we've specifically seen with public cloud computing, which is almost infinite scale that you're paying for on demand, not paying for it when you're not using it, which would not be true in a private cloud where you've got captive hosted hardware. Secondly, some of the aspects like being marked to market to Moore's Law. In our case, Amazon Web Services continuously upgrading their hardware where you wouldn't be doing that at that rate in a private data center. So being marked to market to Moore's Law is a second major benefit of this. And then the third is the cybersecurity. There's just no way that a commercial firm that's doing it themselves is going to be able to invest the level of resource to get the high cyber controls that you see in a public cloud vendor.
Mm. And you know, you've talked about it, forgive me, as it's inherent in your response, but I want to just make sure it's very clear as well, as you've been kind enough to mention this in the past, the economics of this really makes sense as well. It's almost an unusual situation where the more you use, the better the economics get. As you pointed out, it's almost without equal or without parallel among technology vendors. Would you mind talking briefly about that?
Yeah, I mean, our data volumes have been going up dramatically with the market volumes and the bull market that we've been experiencing over the last 2 or 3 years. So our data volumes have gone up significantly since we've moved to the cloud, as well as we moved many additional applications to the cloud. And I could say that over that time, our actual cloud costs have gone down. And I've never seen that with any technology platform or vendor in my career.
So yeah, very, very impressive. And can you also talk a bit about, you've also had some advantages in being so committed to AWS that perhaps others, especially at maybe not quite the scale that you have as few do, but the advantages of being able to help shape solutions and work more as a partner, perhaps in your work with AWS. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, their customer service philosophy is to help their clients reduce their costs. They've had, you know, dozens and dozens of unsolicited price reductions since they've been in existence, since, you know, the mid part of the last decade. Basically passing on cost savings on an unsolicited basis to their clients. And then from an engineering standpoint, helping clients learn how to use their platform so that their clients could do so efficiently. And this has been one of the main reasons why our work in the cloud has become more economical over time. And again, that's just not something that you're going to see with other vendors.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've had a really interesting professional background, even academic background, for somebody who has been a CIO. You have a computer science undergraduate degree. You have an MBA from the Booth School at the University of Chicago. You spent time as a consultant with IBM, all of this before becoming a CIO. And I can only imagine the orientation of the broader business set of skills that you first got academically, that you also then had the more practical experience as a consultant with, oriented you a bit differently once you took on IT roles. In fact, with your first CIO role at the Chicago Stock Exchange, you also headed operations. You were the head of operations and technology, a fairly early example of somebody having those combined sets of skills, now becoming a little bit more broadly applied, but still fairly rare. You went on to CIO posts at NASDAQ, at Citibank, before this one at FINRA. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your own perspective on the evolution of the role. You know, even anyone who's listening to this, as they hear you describe your set of responsibilities here at FINRA, will certainly hear, in some cases, unusual aspects to what you are doing relative to, let's say, the average CIO. But I wonder if you can just reflect, now that you've been multi-decades a chief information officer, how you've seen that role evolve.
Yeah, I don't think the role has changed too much from my perspective. I think there has been a trend more towards centralization of IT for efficiency. I certainly saw that transition during my days at Citibank. But my CIO role at Chicago Stock Exchange and at NASDAQ were largely centralized IT functions, as it is at FINRA today. A lot of talk about the difference between a CTO and a CIO. I don't really see much of a difference. I see the same roles having one or the other title. I think, you know, in general, I think healthy IT is where the technology team is a trusted advisor and partner with the business that they support, looking for innovative solutions that maybe the business couldn't do on their own, as opposed to an order-taking role. And as I go into organizations as a CIO over the last 22 years, one of my first priorities, after building a good team of IT managers and strategists, is to ensure that the relationship between the IT function and the business is that of a trusted advisor.
That's excellent. I wanted to also just conclude by asking you, we've talked about a number of rising trends in IT. Are there others, as you look, say, 2 or 3 years out, that particularly excite you, some things that are either personally or professionally making their way onto your roadmap?
I think robotics and automation. I've been studying a lot on that. I've actually had a couple speaking engagements on the subject. And while it is a bit futuristic, I think concepts like the second half of the chessboard and how the Moore's Law is getting to a point where we're now starting since 2006 seeing exponential increases in price performance versus what we did since the 1960s, the early parts of the Moore's Law, that we're going to now see the ability to automate things that just weren't possible to automate. There's a lot of comparisons to the Industrial Revolution with where we are with technology. It took many decades for the machinery that fed the Industrial Revolution to mature, 50 years, in fact. And again, we've seen technology maturing over the last 50, 60 years, and what we're going to see in the next 20 years is going to be incredible compared to what we've seen in 50 years. And that's going to drive the ability to do robotics and automation that really hasn't been achievable until now. And so I think we're going to see a massive displacement of labor by machines. And so I think that's one of the key trends that we'll probably be witnessing in the next 15, 20 years.
Does that make the CIO, is it in danger, or does it actually strengthen the role of the CIO given that change, do you think?
I think it strengthens it. And I would encourage everyone to, have their kids get engineering and computer science degrees, because there's going to be a lot more work to do in that regard in terms of programming machines to replace labor.
That's excellent. Well, Steve Randage, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been great to get your perspectives. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Kimberly Johnson, the Chief Operating Officer of Fannie Mae.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's 5 principles of world class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.